January is when we recommit to the habits that support our health and well-being. And naturally, we start looking at what can support those goals, including supplements. But choosing the right supplements can be confusing, because not only are there so many brands out there, the supplement industry itself is a low-trust category. It's lightly regulated, products are easy to make, and companies don't even have to list everything on their label. Now, there's Momentous. They've become the high-trust brand in a low-trust category. They weren't satisfied with the industry standard, so they built the Momentous Standard, their commitment to doing things the right way, not the easy way. Momentous sources the highest quality ingredients on the planet. Their whey protein comes from grass-fed European dairy cows. Their creatine uses the purest form of creatine monohydrate, and every formula is made with clinically backed, highly bioavailable nutrients, with no fillers and no artificial sweeteners. Right now, Momentous is offering listeners up to 35% off your first order with promo code AudioBoom. Head to livemomentous.com and use promo code AudioBoom for up to 35% off your first order. That's livemomentous.com, promo code AudioBoom.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello and welcome to this interview. I had the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Erik Lidstrom, the author of Education and Changed. And we spoke about several matters, such as evolutionary psychology, the knowledge problem, and the pitfalls of centralizing education. Please enjoy. Right. So first of all, let me just start by asking you, what's going on in Sweden at the moment? Because we are listening to news that say that there are several bombings in the country.
It's not good. And okay. It's... I at the moment, I don't see any hope for improvements either. It's sort of the perfect storm. As you may know, there's a bombing a day and there's people being shot here and there. And it's a combination of, I would say, the world's silliest legal system introduced in the 1960s. So if you murder someone when you're 17 or 15 or so, then you get at maximum 4 years of closed youth care at might not even be a enclosed prison for you, because you're a child. You have to, it's an illness to commit a crime. So people have to be nice to you and then you'll be good again, because you're only a child. If you're under 15, nothing at all happens, basically. And so a crime here, a brutal rape, could give you 2 years of that compared to 30 years in prison in France. And that was introduced in the 60s. And then we have the welfare state, so that people are, if they have lots of children and don't work, they get essentially more money than if they worked. And then mass migration. Mass immigration, and you combine those, then you get what you get.
It looks like this is basically late stage statism, where people are incentivized to not work, and those who do work are disrespected because they are somehow forced in order to procure welfare for those who are unproductive and sometimes downright
in a sense. But if you compare to France, the French have a rather cynical view of human nature. They don't trust people. Whilst in Sweden, the official dogma is that everyone is nice, basically. And you can't be harsh, too harsh on them. After all, and I use scare quotes, they are small brown people, and then they are treated like children, even though they are mass murderers.
I'm not going to lie. I remember some years ago, I was reading a newspaper about Scandinavia and prisons especially, and they were showing prisons in Scandinavia, and they showed images that would remind people of really luxurious hotels. And they were essentially saying that... So that wasn't an exaggeration. That wasn't
No, the prison... There's an article from 2014. Sweden had the most expensive prisons in Europe per prisoner, except for San Marino. But San Marino only had one prisoner. So it's six times the average in Sweden. And we have an extremely low incarceration rate. And if you look at data from 2004, I think it was, we have three times the criminality of the United States, for example. But and now after that, a million and a half immigrants have arrived from culturally incompatible nations to a large degree.
Do you think that there are any reasons to be optimistic at the moment about Scandinavia and Sweden in particular?
I think you can be optimistic about Denmark and Finland. Finland, the Finns don't go for this being nice to people approach. And the Danes have really woken up. In Sweden, it's hopeless at the moment. There is no party in parliament that can do anything about it. And there's no party that can get into parliament either. I've heard you discuss on the Lotus Eaters proportional representation. But the most right-wing you get then is Sunak, I would say. Mainly you have 80% Lib Dems and Labour. That's what you get in parliament. And no one else can get into...
So the question to ask there is, what has to happen for people of that persuasion to, in a sense, wake up? How more tragic events must happen for people to stop being so, let's say, ridiculously charitable about this?
It reminds me of Trump derangement syndrome, that people are, even though all the information in the world is available today, we have the internet. You can get to all the sources. You can watch any person in live or what they said in an interview or read about them. But people don't. So you have, we're supposed to have multiculturalism in Sweden. But it's like in Britain. You have enclaves of people living. They live sort of back to back to each other. They don't interact. Maybe those who work, you see them as bus drivers and nurses and so on and so forth. But people don't socialize after work. There's no reason for it. And there is this mathematical formula. I think Schelling's law of segregation. I don't know if you've heard of that.
It's an economist. No, I will. If you don't mind, I'll type it. You said
Schelling. I think SCH Schelling. But basically, it says that you get segregation, even though you don't need to have racism or hatred for each other. It's just that you have a bit of friction. Sort of people don't get along. It's maybe their kids are too loud, or it doesn't smell right, they're cooking or something like that. So people, one person after another, when they move, because people move, they move to an area where they feel more comfortable. So even though there is no serious animosity, you get segregation. So you get islands of, in Britain, Pakistan is here, you get Somalis, and you get... Sunni Arabs in one area, and so on and so forth. And they don't interact. So the people, those in power, it's like in Britain, I would say, those in power are a bit wealthier. They live in nice neighborhoods. They are not affected. So why would they care?
Do you think that sometimes it's not just an issue of not being personally affected, but also an issue of ideology? And that is important here. I'll just give you an example that happened hours ago. Now, this interview is going to be uploaded in a few weeks from now. But today we had the tragic incident in Germany, in Munich, where an Afghan asylum seeker literally drove a car into a group of leftists. I think they're called the Verdi organization. And they instantly made an announcement that we're not going to talk, we don't want to give any room to far right racism. A car literally
People's self-perception is very important, and their beliefs are very important, and they usually are, they are protected from intrusion. I remember, I can't find the article, but the 9/11, after 9/11, people came together in the United States. It was a terrible tragedy, but it took nine months before George Bush was the devil again, and corrupt and so on and so forth, according to the media. It's sort of as long as people don't get their house bombed, they don't shift opinions. So it's tragic.
And would you say that this suggests that there is a more or less fixed human nature, that the sort of narrative that destroys Europe and the West at the moment is trying to tell us it does not exist? In other words, would you say, for instance, that the law of segregation that you mentioned is something that is supposed to be an inevitable outcome of human interaction?
I would say, yeah. Sort of formulate my thoughts. I think this Thomas Sowell's the vision of the anointed class. So I think Deirdre McCloskey calls them the clerisy. They form a tribe of their own, which is close to the outside, and they're happy. They go to the same dinner parties, and they speak to the same people, read the same newspapers in Britain. They watch the BBC, and they're happy. They see a world that is okay, nothing, no problem here. And
I think we have the same in the UK, the same in Greece, and I think it's the same in every other Western country.
Yeah.
It's exactly the class that you just said, as Thomas Sowell described them, as the anointed. I think they have lost any kind of sentiment that is patriotic. They will say that they are patriots, but they do not understand patriotism as I would say it's traditionally understood. They seem to me to be very much viewing themselves as the enlightened ones.
If I remember, Intellectuals and Society, if you read that book by Thomas Sowell, he talks about French intellectuals, and they were in the 1930s, they had survived the horrors of the First World War, and now they were citizens of the world, and they didn't want militarism and so on and so forth. And then France got invaded, and as he says, much to their credit, lots of them died in the resistance afterwards. But they flipped, and that flipped their worldview. But we are peace damaged is a Swedish expression from 200 years of no wars in Sweden. But it's less than that, I would say. It's from 1970 that things turned really ugly here.
So you would say that ever since the 70s, Sweden has been very much welfarist, and that's the main reason of the situation we see today.
What happened was that, well, it's a 20th century history. 1914, there were big demonstrations against the militarization and so and so forth. And suddenly, soon after, First World War came. And then in the middle of the 1917, I think Sweden could mobilize 600,000 well-trained soldiers. And there was a competition for a while between the Entente and the Central Powers, and they wanted Sweden to join because 600,000 men were important. And then came the Eternal Peace in 1918, and Sweden closed down half the defense in 1925 and continued demobilizing. So in 1936, it was decided to increase defense spending to 1.5% of GDP. And if I calculate correctly, in 1940, it went to 21%. And then it stayed about 20% during the whole war. So the class of politicians that were caught with their trousers down in 1940, really, when Denmark and Norway were occupied, they were in power until about 1970. Then they retired, and then there was a new era of perpetual peace that lot of politicians thought they were living in. And that's where we are now.
So I regularly see several socialist or socialist-leaning people who upload articles about Scandinavian. They say that the Scandinavian countries are the model of social democrat countries and that they are the happiest countries to be alive. Now, I'm generally speaking, I'm not a doomer and I don't want to advocate gloom or something, but would you say that this is far-fetched and that this is a sort of narrative that they are communicating in order to hide the sad realities that exist?
I don't think they're hiding anything. I mean, Sweden was an extremely homogeneous country.
Okay.
Where people, very conformist. Until 1850 in Sweden, most people lived in small villages where everyone knew everyone else and knew what they were doing. So people don't want to speak out and they stick to themselves. It's I would say, very hard to get to know Swedes, to get integrated in Sweden for a foreigner. So Swedes are not, and then we live in a corner of the world. We are not used to foreigners. I mean, you are Greek, you know that the Turks are different, the Bulgarians are different, the former Yugoslavians are different. They have, and Swedes think that everyone is the same, and the dream of everyone is to become a Swede. That is actual, I would say, a majority opinion in Sweden, that as soon as people arrive in Sweden, they see how great we are and they then want to become Swedish. It sounds silly to someone from middle of Central Europe, but that's a common opinion here.
I think that this is an opinion that I have heard from several countries. And yes, I do think that this is, it's not particularly surprising for me to hear it, but I understand this. So I wanted to ask you about I want us to set up the context that will make your insights a bit more intelligible to our audience, because I think that you're largely operating within a tradition that I would refer to as classical liberal. Is that correct?
That's
you are writing a book about it, which I have read, and I thought it was really good. So one of the problems with classical liberalism is that in today's world, I think that this is from the last decades, that in some cases, there are several good defenses of it that seem a bit counterintuitive. And that a lot of people, when they come across several implications of the theory or in several, let's say, areas such as education, their knee-jerk reaction is to say, okay, well, this is all nonsense. It goes against what my intuition says, so I'm going to just reject it. But it seems to me that there is far more into the tradition, and you are actually making a very good job at describing about this in your books. And you're referring to anthropology and also to evolutionary psychology. Yeah, you also mentioned that they are very much influenced by the ideas of the Scottish Enlightenment, particularly the ideas of David Hume and Adam Smith, and people who follow that tradition, such as Hayek and Sowell in the 20th century. So yeah. I think the best way to start is to talk about these theories and then talk about the knowledge problem, which I think forms the, let's say, the cornerstone of your of the argument of your book, and then start going to more specific areas about education and educational reform and what you think the government does particularly bad when it comes to education. So what do you think are the basic insights you're drawing from anthropology and evolutionary psychology?
Well, first of all, that we are a biological being. We have human nature, and it might appear as we have culture. Our human nature is modulated by culture. And we get the impression that culture is infinitely malleable, and that's a common opinion. But it operates within strict bounds, and cultures are sort of varieties of on a theme, you could say. So the basics don't differ; it's the details that differ, and. Our intellect is designed also to pick up on differences. So we forget about it. One of the strongest indicators of someone is foreign is an accent, which you can't fake. And probably fashion is also a way of distinguishing people, groups from each other. So we think that we see infinite variety, whilst at the same time we have a language that is designed to evolve away from other groups so that we have our own lingo and so on and so forth. Any study of human behavior should really, if it's possible, we should ground it in evolutionary psychology, evolutionary biology. I think that should be the base assumption. But then there are things that are different in the book. I don't know if you've read anything about what I sent you, but there is also, we live in a different world today. We live in what Adam Smith called the Great Society, which is a complex adaptive system where people interact with people they don't know. And there's a quote by Jared Diamond said that with the rise of, if I remember correctly, with agricultural societies 8,500 years ago, for the first time in history, we had to meet foreign people without trying to kill them, which was the default for 2 million years of human existence. So it's Our world is very strange, and our gut reactions to certain problems are not what they should be in the market economy. Let's put it that way.
They're unreliable, you mean?
I mean that we can accept that we can trade, buy and sell things when it comes to bicycles or cameras or computers and so on. But as soon as we come to human beings, and especially vulnerable human beings, we have an obligation, a tribal obligation to help those in need. So on the one hand, people will want to pitch in. On the other hand, they want everyone to do something about it. So then we get the worst performing areas of human society are probably healthcare, care for the elderly, other vulnerable people. With regard to education, we also have a deep desire for social conformity. And that's what I'm arguing in the book, that to a large degree, education has become a tribal ritual that you have to go through. People have to go to school. And I try to argue you need to get an education, and school is just a tool. But since it has become such a ritual, like an initiation rite in tribes. It's if you don't go to school, you're tainted. You can't be trusted, and that's a serious serious issue for understanding the problem of education correctly. I don't know if I make myself understood clearly, but because it's a very complicated area.
Yes, I think it's good if we take each of these insights into isolation, because I think that they're really rich, and I want our audience to appreciate them. Mm-hmm. So we have so many years of evolution, so many 2 million years, as you mentioned, and for the most part of that, we are sort of habituated by being, by the universe, into living in hunter-gatherer societies.
Yeah.
And of a really small number.
Yeah, about the average of a human gathered tribe is about 500.
Right.
That's a whole country.
So this is what 2 million years of evolution have prepared us for.
More than two. I mean, it's basically hundreds of millions of years of evolution. Because we also had the baggage when we came in to becoming hunter-gatherers. We had a history that had to be taken into account.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Thanks for the correction. So, and suddenly with, you would say, ingenuity and technology, the world has been transformed much faster than our nature has been allowed to adapt to it. Is that a good way of putting it?
Because sort of.
I think what I see in philosophy, which I think in many ways is very much different to evolutionary psychology, we do see a kind of clash between what is called our habitual nature and our rational nature. And I would say even an ultra-rationalist like Leibniz would say that 3/4 of us are habitual.
Mm.
So he wasn't someone who would say, well, if reason tells us something should be done, it can be immediately done, and there is no bad implication that may come out of it. So I think that this is something that actually we may be a bit more habitual, as you may be implying, I think, and that we have been habituated so much into conditions, but for millions of years, that now have changed rapidly. And they also seem to change rapidly even in the last 10,000 years. Is that the issue? That we sort of, evolutionary lag?
There are certain things like the internet and social media and so on that are really truly novel phenomena, I think you could say. But technology as such, making a stone axe or a fishing net or a cathedral, they are not that different. What is different is that we interact in the market with people we don't know, and our prosperity requires that we set aside our intuitive desires and just treat certain aspects as just like things, just like money. And that's possible when it comes to to hard objects, but it's not possible when it comes to people. So if you want good healthcare, government should not be involved. We should let people interact freely between themselves, but our instincts tell us that we must do something together, and that it is sinful, and it's really despicable to charge money from a patient, for example, because that is your obligation is to help them. But if you try to do that, the whole market economy breaks down. It works for 20 people, but it doesn't work for 50 million. That's a key issue, and I think it's Benjamin Constant. I think Hayek quotes him and says that classical liberalism is an ideology of principle. There are principle rules that we must follow. And even though they sound counterintuitive or bad, if everyone, it's like the rule of law, if everyone follows these rules all the time, the overall picture will be prosperity. But in each instance, we might say that I would like to make a slight deviation here and makes an exception and so on and so forth. And then everything breaks down.
Exactly. So I think one of the implications from this view is that there are several moral views that are particularly opposed to the kind of distinct layers of society that, for instance, Hume and Smith are talking about, that lead to deviations from this. And let me rephrase it, because I express this in a very abstract way. As you said, Smith said we're living in great society. And I think that he wrote a book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which I think is a very important book to understand before someone reads The Wealth of Nations.
Yeah.
And it forms the backdrop of his theory. And he says that on the one hand, we live on a neighborhood level with our friends and neighbors. And on the other hand, we are citizens of an extended order, or citizens of great society. And our moral sentiments are mostly attached into our day-to-day interaction, human interactions at the neighborhood level. But we shouldn't think of it like that when it comes to society as an extended order. And let me just give an example that I can think about. It's policing. In a small neighborhood, everyone knows each other. So it's very difficult for the police to actually do the work, because it's not impersonal. It's not the officer who is arresting the criminal. It's John, the son of Matthew and Helen, who's arresting Pete, the son of, let's say, Josh and Samantha. Let me just give names. And that's likely to cause feuds and cause vendettas. And there are all sorts of problems that can be solved by more impersonal institutions when we are talking about distinct neighborhoods that must live, coexist together under a common umbrella. Do you think that this is sort of a way?
I think this is an area where we solve the problem, or we solve the problem so far as it could be solved by, if you read Homicide by Mark Wilson and Daly, for example, it's a book on evolutionary psychology, but it's talk about United. It's also Steven Pinker's book on The Better Angels of Our Future talks about this. But you get there is a distinct problem in hunter-gatherer society, in that you are often faced with this problem that you need to get justice, but you have to sort it out yourself, and that can require revenge killings that go on, feuds that go on forever. And it is in Papua New Guinea, they say when the Australians came in there and finally put an end to it, they were delighted, because suddenly you could go out in the morning out of the hut and have a pee without fearing having an arrow through your body as soon as you stepped out of your hut, which was the standard, what they were living in for millions of years, tens of thousands of years. So that part of it, that the king's peace has externalized it, because if there's an obligation, the whole society, the whole clan has to get together to try to kill someone else to get justice. And this is hazardous business. And if you can find a third party that can be trusted to deal with this, that's fine. And with regard to policing, That part wasn't, that was also solved before. The police was a local guy, or the police was everyone who dealt with this. And they had the justice of the peace, who was an impartial third party. So that part worked. Where it doesn't work is when you nationalize the police, and the policemen, they are. It's in Sweden, as it is in Britain, I think that you have the Scotland Yard, you have the National Police in Sweden. They are not attached locally, and they are torn between. They have a few friends who are subject to crime, and then they have these well, left-wing policies that you should be nice to the criminal because really they are the sufferers, and so on. So the whole thing breaks down because the policing was local before. That's
Right. So I think we need to talk about the knowledge problem here, because I think it's something that that is derived precisely from these considerations that we have mentioned right now, and is really important, not just for education, but also for the market, for basically everything. So how would you describe the knowledge problem in, say, a simple way?
The issue is that we all know different things, and everyone knows different things. Everyone has different wants and desires, and we don't know what others don't know, knows, and we don't know what we know ourselves even. You can't describe to yourself even how to ride a bicycle. And there's many things that we do that we only discover we can do when we have to do them. And other people know other things. So knowledge is distributed in all of society between millions of people or billions of people. And the amazing thing, what Hayek pointed out and or formalized, I think Edmund Burke essentially talks about the same thing in an essay, is that the signaling system in a market economy is money, prices. And that's, as he says, is such an astonishing thing that it would, if someone had invented it, it would have been sort of Nobel Prize worthy 10 times over. Everything is collapsed into a number. And that sounds cynical, but you can decide if you have, say, 100 tons of iron, what should you do with the iron? In the Soviet Union, they had no prices, so they didn't know. So should you make nails? Should you make railroad tracks? Should you make screws? Should you do, what is the purpose? What should you do with this? And the price tells you what you can do with it and cannot do with it. And so it is for millions of things. I think, I can't remember the book from the top of my head now. Company of Strangers, it's called. In New York alone, there are 10 billion stock keeping units in the city. There are things that can change price from one day to the next, from one hour to the next. And everything is coordinated that way without anyone having to organize a society. And
It's like a
that is
spontaneous order.
a spontaneous order. But I read about a professor said that this paper, The Use of Knowledge in Society, which Hayek published in 1945, he said he reread it once a year, and he thought he discovered new things every time, because it's 10 pages and it's mind-blowing when you get to it, and it's counterintuitive. People, you don't understand how can you measure something by money? Yeah, but it's a light by which we see in a large society. That's the important thing.
Would you say that this is directly relevant also to the debate about economic calculation that
Exactly.
the Austrians had in the 20s? But was it Mises and Hilferding who were?
Well, von Mises, he said in 1920, I think, in the paper, which for some reason he was a major in the First World War, and somehow he managed to write things anyway. He published this, and he pointed out that Marx had talked about the state going away and everyone would share equally and so on and so forth. There would be no capitalism. And he pointed out that then you can't make economic calculations, because the only prices are decided in the market, and it's exactly this thing. And then a few other economists, socialist economists, they tried to work around that problem in the 1930s, and Hayek wrote three papers on it and did the big smackdown. And he used his theory of knowledge being distributed as the basis for it, whilst von Mises used prices as a bit cruder. So I think Hayek's formulation is more thorough, you could say. But essentially what's happened, as far as I can tell, in the economics profession is that, okay, well, moving on, most economists work for the government in universities, or they work in big banks, and they don't consider the knowledge problem. So they make their beautiful theories anyway.
Sadly, this is the case. Mm. Right. So let us now go and talk about education, because I started reading your book, and in the beginning you make an observation, and I just said, wait a minute, this is basically true and brilliant. You said that a lot of people, the knee-jerk reaction when people talk about education is that people have an idea of how education should be. Mm. They also have an idea of why education has failed, because it deviates from their ideal about how education should be. And they want, in order to see how to improve things, to create a board of experts.
Mm.
And that is going to lay down the principles of reform. But what you observe is that it's almost never the case that the best author of literature is also a professor of literature, that the best musician is also a professor of music, that the best, let's say, trader or something is a professor of economics.
Mm.
So, and I think we can go on forever.
So Elon Musk had to become a space engineer. He didn't know anything about rockets. He wanted to go fly to Mars. So he had to become a space engineer. He has no degree in that area whatsoever. That's...
I think that this is the main thing we need to tell people. And I also want to ask you about this. What is it precisely you think that is most people's idea of how education reform should come about? And why do you think it's mistaken?
I think most people, building on what you said there, have an idea from their own childhood. They saw what seemed to work and what didn't seem to work. And then they think a few more fixes. You should have order in the classroom and more resources and higher salaries for teachers and more stringent requirements and performance league tables, I think they're called in the UK, and so on and so forth. So you measure things. And then you've seen that picture. And then a miracle happens and you get good education. The problem is that there are no such experts that can do it. And it's education is a very complicated area where you talk to people. You deal with people, and I mean, you can't put the professor of musicology and write the next hit song. It doesn't work like that. It's trial and error, and we think all these. Mike Tyson said that everyone's got a plan, and then they get until they get hit in the face, and they have to readjust. And all those beautiful things that people think up when they think they know what education is and how it should be done, when they try them out, they won't quite work. And will be the wrong people and the wrong teaching methods and so on and so forth.
So. Right. So I think it's really important to draw a distinction here because it's a distinction that most people don't draw, is that it's one thing to teach.
Yeah.
The skill of teaching is one thing, and quite another to implement educational reform. And a lot of the time, the people who are advocating for really strong education reform along the lines or along statist lines, they seem to me to not be aware of the difference. And they say, sorry.
Now, I think teaching has become, it's like a lot of areas in society has become an academic subject. And whilst it is a trade, it's a craft, how to teach something. You practice makes perfect as a teacher. And it's been turned into an academic subject with professors of pedagogy and so on and so forth. And something I point out in my book is that you have an area of education which is, when it worked, was based on 2,500 years of trial and error, beginning with the Greeks, the European tradition of teaching. Other countries have other traditions, but it's based on trial and error. And now you turn it into an academic subject. And then you have to get a PhD in teaching. So how do you get a PhD in something? You discover something new. So you have something, how to teach, which you don't need to know how to express how you teach even. You just do it and it works. So you have to come up with a theory that goes away from proven practice, discover something new. So as soon as you get a PhD, you can basically be certain that anyone with a PhD in pedagogy has sort of discovered something that doesn't work or deviates from proven practice. That's
but they haven't found something that actually works.
Well, they are not tested on that. I mean, I don't know how it is in Britain, but here in Sweden, someone made a study and said that 2 to 3% of PhDs in education were based on used empirical data. 97-98% did not use empirical data, but they got their PhDs anyway.
What the idea I wanted to push forward with what I said before in the distinction is that there is the importance of gaining expertise. And I think, is it Daniel Kahneman who got a Nobel Prize in who said that in order to be truly considered an expert in a field, you need to have devoted around 10,000 hours of dedicated practice of that skill. And a lot of teachers may end up getting that amount of expertise, but it's completely different when it comes to education reform, because in education reform, as you mentioned, I think in the book, there isn't so much trial and error involved as there is in teaching.
Well, in practice, there's none at all, because or virtually none at all, because I think this Kahneman says that it takes 10 to 20 years normally to prepare an education reform. A national education reform. And then if you want to evaluate what it brought, you have to wait another 10 to 20 years. That takes 12 years to go through school, and it takes time for the reform to settle. And then you have the old teachers that might not pay lip service to the new ideas and not teach according to them. So say you can make if you want to do this properly, every 20 to 40 years, you can implement the national school reform, education reform. And and most of them make education worse.
So it's basically the equivalent of having a 20 or 40 year plan.
Yeah. So if you want to wait until government gets it right, you should put your children into liquid helium, liquid nitrogen, and wait 2,000-3,000 years. Then maybe they get it right.
It seems to me that it's remarkably analogous to the market, and especially when we are comparing the, let's say, freer economies with freer markets and really centralized systems such as the Soviet Union. It seems to me that we see a distinction, a yeah, a distinction, a sharp distinction between, on the one hand, having an economy where there are all sorts, there are various experiments, economic experiments, and the risk of each of them failing is minimized because if one experiment fails, 10 others may succeed.
Well, 9 out of 10 probably fail, but they have to be corrected immediately. You have to backpedal immediately and go back to what you did before and try something different. Yeah. Otherwise, you go out of business.
But in the opposite case, when it comes to the 5-year plan, you have just one giant economic experiment.
And if it fails, everything. Yeah, you have thousands of people working on this reform, and then it's introduced, and everything goes down the drain. I would say one way of selling my argument might be that if you look back at your own schooling and you think of, you had very good teachers and you had some poor teachers, and what would happen in market system is that the good teachers would get more pupils and teach friends to be as good as they are, and all the bad teachers would disappear. They can't sustain themselves. They would just have to do something else.
Yeah,
and that's that doesn't happen in a national school system.
Right. So I think I want us to approach what you're saying from another angle, because there are several questions I have that I wouldn't say necessarily are rejections of what you're saying, but I want to see how they could be incorporated in your framework. So, first of all, what is education? Because that's a very important question when we start talking about the quality of education and education as being an important good or value in our lives. It may be a good idea if we come up with a definition or at least an approach towards.
Maybe take it from the start, sort of. When you live as a hunter-gatherer or as a peasant farmer, they don't do education. The children learn lots of things, and they're rarely taught, but they copy their parents and they copy older friends, and they learn how to work in that environment. But then you get more advanced things in society, like reading and writing, that are called biologically secondary things that you need to. Your brain is not designed to do it. So you have to repeat and practice these things. And so what you could say, education boils down to primary education. I love the English term primary education, is the body of knowledge that it is socially expected that everyone should possess. You could say in modern society, it's reading, writing, arithmetic, a bit of history, and you need to understand the political society you live in, and so on. And if you're a Swede or a Greek, you need to learn English as well. And this body of knowledge, if you possess that body of knowledge, you're treated like a functioning part of society. If you're not, you're treated like an idiot, essentially. Because it's socially expected that you have this body. And then, so that is the core of education. And then there is secondary education, which is more advanced stuff, which has unfortunately become compulsory. So where you learn several foreign languages, more advanced history, more advanced chemistry, physics, mathematics, and so on a more advanced level. Which really most people don't apply in life, but it was as it developed, it was something a minority or not so small minority used for their trades, you could say.
And right. So I have several questions. So first of all, it seems to me that in hunter-gatherer society, there is such a process of educating, not in a conventional sense where we have a classroom and we have a teacher. But for instance, in the sense of transmitting know-how.
Yeah, but it's usually done by copying.
Wouldn't that be a kind of education?
Yes, but it's sort of it's called Cultural Learning is one way of Heinrich has written a book about that.
Okay.
So children copy. They're not. They are. I discovered this recently. They are rarely taught. They just watch their parents and copy, and then they're told to go do that, and they do that. So.
Right. And when you are saying that education is a body of knowledge that is socially required for people to be seen as members of society, I'd presume you mean primary education, like
basic, primary education, yeah.
Basic arithmetic skills and stuff, because we can be educated in really niche fields that a lot of people don't know what they are. They can't be making any demands that we know of them in order to not be treated as outcasts. So you're talking about the primary education.
Yes, and that I think that's the problem with the education debate is that as long as education, the compulsory education or voluntary education, only concerned primary education, it was voluntarily entered into, and everyone did it, and everyone learned it, whether it was in a private school or in a later on government schools. But then government started to tack on secondary education and force it upon everyone. And that created the culture of large swathes of society hating education. Yeah, in Britain, you have a white underclass that used to be the pillars of society. I don't know if you read The Life at the Bottom of Dalrymple. It talks about how the welfare state has, but also education, has destroyed the white working class. And because people don't want to be force-fed these things. They are not interested.
Do you think there's a natural reaction to rebel against what it is you're being taught?
I think what happened in Sweden when it became compulsory to continue after age 13 was that immediately you got chaos in the last, they added 3 years. And this chaos then spread during the 1970s down to, well, first year of school. And now you have the second generation, now soon third generation of children whose parents and soon grandparents hated school. And the whole thing is breaking down.
Right. So I want to ask you about the issue of regulation here, because it seems to me that we are talking about centralization and decentralization in education as if we're taking the two extremes of the two extreme options. But perhaps there are several arguments to be made against particular regulations or not. Of course, there's what you said in the very beginning, that the moment you start making exceptions, you have a problem. But let us run the argument for that sake. So for instance, when we're talking about a body of knowledge that needs to be accepted, or at least it needs to be socially accepted. So what if people in politics, we have politicians who end up in a position where they can actually influence things, and they say that I need to instill a sentiment of patriotism in children through education, and education is teaching them the exact opposite, and I want to change that, and that could actually manifest in all sorts of ways. One way would be to have a very strictly centralized system of education that said that this is what you're going to be taught, and a kind of patriotism is going to be part of it. Or you could have a sort of mixed system where you say, where the government says, well, you will have to teach A, B, and C, but you are free with respect to D, E, F, G, H, I, J, whatever. Do you think that would be disastrous?
What do you mean? The point to instill certain values in the population, essentially.
Yes.
That
and these values, not just because someone wakes up and says, "Okay, I want to do social engineering,"
I mean, I know it's been done. I know that small French children learned about the Gauls, and the Swedish children learned about the Swedish heroes, and so on and so forth. And people were, I mean, they read about Charles the 12th and Gustavus Adolphus and Charles the 10th going across, crushing Denmark, and so on and so forth. And I mean, it was Swedish history is rock and roll. It's Swedish history the last, well, for between 1500 and really between 1300 and 1721 is like Greek, as much rock and roll as Greek history in the antiquity. It's sort of heroic things and feats of arms and stuff. So that's interesting, and it was instilled in schools and so on and so forth. But you had the homogeneous society where everyone agreed on everything already. So it wasn't a problem. It wasn't like force fed into people. I think in the modern world where things have gone haywire, I don't think education is the wrong tool to install. It's like in the States now you have Donald Trump, who it's really the revolt of the masses against the anointed, you could say. And he's a big wrecking ball. And patriotism should come from a great country. You should have a country to be proud of. And then it comes on its own. You don't need to spoon feed it.
Right. But the reason I'm asking is because if, for instance, we have really strong lobbies in other countries, and let's say there are other countries other than England that have a really strong lobby within England. And they, as you said, that they create enclaves and they have schools of their own and suddenly start teaching anti-English propaganda. Wouldn't that be an issue? Wouldn't that be, for instance, a call for the government to regulate that?
Both in Sweden and in Britain, we are late to the party. If there had been one or two children per class out of 30 in that category, go ahead, that could work. Not that when you have enclaves. I mean, people go to mosque schools and so on in Sweden. They don't learn anything during the day, but they study the Quran during the evenings, and so the same in Britain. The tool to which I'm trying to convince people of without much success, and I think you agree, is the tool to use is the welfare state. It should go. The benefits should go completely. And if you don't have a welfare state, if you use the Christian message from Paul, Saint Paul, those who don't work shall not eat, he says. And if you take it down to sleeping in army barracks with three meals a day, so you survive, nothing else, then the rest of the problem would sort itself out. I think quite a few people would leave both Britain and Sweden, and others, I don't know how big the enclave problem is in Britain, if they would leave or if they would stay, but they would have to interact with the rest of society to survive. And
yes,
interact with the rest of society, they can live peacefully without interacting with society, but they have to sort themselves out without otherwise other people paying for them.
Right. So another question I have here comes from my experience as a teacher, because I was teaching at the university for 6 years. And of course, I think what we're talking about is really important, and you are highlighting the importance of context. And a lot of the people who are comprising bodies of experts, they very frequently think in abstract ways, but ignoring context. I think one of the things that come to mind is if education is treated entirely as a commodity, there could be some avenues towards the, let's say, decreasing of quality in education. Obviously, this could go the other way around. A centralized education can lead into a very bad education system. But one of the things I saw is that in England, for instance, there are some universities like Oxford and Cambridge that have centuries of history and a tradition and a name and a reputation that they have made throughout centuries that they're just not going to be topped. And there are several other universities that are competing with them in order to gain, let's say, funding and in order to also get a name outside. And they compete for student satisfaction. And sadly, student satisfaction is one of those indexes that a lot of universities go for because it's something that they think they can deliver easily. And what I saw was a complete decrease, a very low quality, let's say, in what was given because students were treated like customers. Because if education is seen, let's say, as a commodity, the there is a tendency to say that the customer is always right. And for instance, in things like philosophy, it's the exact opposite because you need to teach, let's say, first year undergraduate philosophy, you need to actually be very painful for them and tell them that, listen, you may think you know, but you don't know. This is the very nature of philosophy.
I think I read in National Review of someone who the teacher explained to her David Hume's the induction problem.
Yes. Yes.
And eventually she ran out crying. She couldn't take it. But I would say, well, first of all, you have in Sweden, you have a slightly different system, but student financing is very, very strange because there's an overproduction in the whole system, not of knowledge, but of you have long education, you don't have good education. As I try to explain my book, what I think would happen if education were to be set free, there were no government involvement in any way, it would resemble the old Swedish system. You would have, and the old English system as well, you would have children would start at 5, 6, or 7, and then they would get a primary education by 11, 12, or 13 or so. Then about probably 60%, based on Swedish numbers, would either start work or do a vocational training. In Sweden, we had 4-year courses to become a carpenter or plumber or all sorts of things. By 16, 17, they are highly trained, skilled workmen. And they know how to read and write. They have a good primary education, which they don't have now. So you get about 40% are left, and they continue for 3 or 4 years and got another secondary education and went on to either work or become a policeman or a nurse or something like that. And then you got 27% at the end took the student exam, which is you've seen, it's a very broad curriculum. It's like the French baccalauréat, which were either BAC-S, it was a science, or it was the Latin humanities, or there was a common mix between the two at the end. And then you have maybe 15, 20% would go on, 2/3 of those would go on to university. If you took a student exam or the BAC from 1968, I would say it's worth about finishing lycée, high school, whatever, in today, plus 6 years additional studies of traditional subjects. That's the level of collapse now. So you are faced at university, you have student satisfaction. What is student satisfaction? You have half an age group go to university because everyone goes to university. And employers, they have no clue what you did, but they know that the higher grade average is better than the lower grade average. So they will favor higher grade average. So the students you have, all they're interested in is, most of them, or a large part of them, is as high grade average for as little effort as possible. So after 4 years, they can get a job. That's it. They are not seeking knowledge.
That's correct. And the final question I want to ask you has to do with what is called negative externalities. And I want to develop a line of thought that I've read somewhere that was interesting. And it had to do with an argument for, let's say, the welfare state. It went like this. It said that, for instance, one of the reasons, one of the main reasons why there needs to be, let's say, social provisions of several, let's say, benefits, social benefits, like education and healthcare to people, is because it minimizes negative externalities, or it prevents negative externalities. And one of the externalities they said they tied to crime. They said, for instance, that the main, let's say, weapon, the main tool the police has isn't physical presence. It's the threat of future punishment. So the driving engine of law enforcement is the fear of future punishment. So when you have a population that is not afraid that they will get caught if they do something, and they think they're going to get away with it, that you are sort of eroding the fear of future punishment. And they're saying that one of the factors that erode the fear of future punishment has to do with destitution in the here and now, but also thinking that you lack a future. And they said that, for instance, a lot of people are much more likely to think that they are desperate in the here and now if, for instance, they think that people aren't going to have their back if, for instance, they get sick, and if they think that they aren't going to have a future, because you're not afraid of future punishment if you think that are not going to have a future. And they tie education with, let's say, the future, and healthcare with the now. What do you think of that argument?
Yeah, but it's not that it's a problem. The welfare state, it's a very good argument, but not for the welfare state. It's an argument against the welfare state, because before you had the welfare state, you had burial societies that actually go back to Rome and continued in medieval Europe. You have fraternal societies, you had temperance lodges, you had friendly societies. I can't remember which one is English and which one is American, but you have millions of people and churches and all sorts of organizations that joined up, and they tried to teach its members self-discipline and how to behave. And if you look at the data from the 19th century Britain, at the same time as there is this argument in favor of, against the disruption of the industrial state, you went from farming with everyone, knew everyone else and took care of each other, supposedly. And then suddenly, from the 1780s or 1800 in Britain, that was all ripped apart, and people moved into the satanic mills, as they called, which is, it's said so, but Charles Dickens never visited. He was a part of the tribal anointed as well. But at the same time as society was ripped apart by this, the old traditional society, you had all these organizations, and they worked hard, and illegitimacy went down, drunkenness went down, savings went up, and people policed themselves. And you got an enormous sense of community, not the same as living in a little village where everyone knows each other, everyone else. But you had all these societies. You had, in Britain, I think you had working men's clubs and so on and so forth. And I'm a great Deep Purple fan. And they used to play, bands used to play in pubs. And there were different pubs for different groups of people all over the place. And people joined up. And the idea behind the welfare state then is this voluntary society comes with strings attached. If you get help from someone, you stand in there, you have to pay back. And if you can't pay back, I mean, it's an obligation you have, and which is hard work. I mean, if you can't, you're forced to contribute. So instead, you come with a welfare state that creates a right, and it pretended to take this sense of community and extend it to everyone in society. But instead, you get faceless abstract rights where all the connections you have with anyone is through the state. So you atomize society.
The middleman.
Yeah, it's sort of you fill in the form. Now you fill it in on the internet and you get your benefits. And you don't need to work for anyone. You don't need to please anyone. And they don't need to work for you or please you either. So the welfare state is like a gigantic pair of scissors that cut through the fabric of society.
And you think it leads to the disintegration of the sentiment of community?
Yes, and, definitely.
And fosters a culture of dependence.
Yeah, and that's what the result of that is. Dalrymple's book, "The Life at the Bottom." It's a horror story, and that was before mass migration into Britain. It was the white working class which was proud, stood in its own 2 feet, and paid in the 19th century. Had all their children went to private schools, and everyone learned how to read and write, and they behaved properly towards their neighbors. And that's been ripped apart.
Right. So thank you very much for this. I enjoyed this.
It was a pleasure.
Where can people find more of your work?
I have created a Substack, which I could provide you a link with. I can't remember it. I have a blog in Swedish, unfortunately, but I started writing in an English Substack. I can send you the link to it.
Thank you very much. Mm. So I found it very interesting and really eye-opening and challenging, because it's like it's a worldview that you're developing that is very distinct and different from the one we're used to being exposed to on a daily basis. So, Dr. Lidström, thank you very much for this.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. So I hope you enjoyed this interview for the Lotus Eaters, and goodbye.
I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play and win from the comfort of your own home, with hundreds of slot games and all of the table games you love with real cash prizes. Right now, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 for new users. It's all at spinquest.com. That's SPINQUEST.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit spinquest.com for more details.
Hello, America. It's your new favourite podcast here.
Yes, it's James and Andy, two forts of the British podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do facts. We do weird facts, fun facts, facts you've never heard before. James, give us a fact.
Did you know you may be able to cure chronically blocked noses with a snot transplant?
Lovely, lovely facts.
If you want to hear us, go to wherever you get your podcasts and search for No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We'll see you there.